Hi, well, welcome. Thanks for coming to this session, What is a Temple? A Preliminary Assessment of Architectural Perceptions. And our presenter will be Brandon Rowe, who is an award-winning designer focusing on sacred architecture. So, Brandon, please come and present your knowledge to us.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. Well, with this topic, so where do we begin? First and foremost, can you hear me okay?
Just as you're
testing me. Okay. So what is Mormonism and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and how does it apply to the Mormon landscape, specifically the theme of this conference? So it's one of the fastest growing Christian faiths in the world. In 2009, the church was building more square footage than Walmart. One historian calls it an American story associated with the molding of the physical environment. One theologian says that Mormonism is halfway between monastery and factory. So, in essence, the Mormon landscape is comprised of sacred spaces that we call temples. And in and of themselves, temples serve as symbols. So looking at the growth trends of church membership and temples throughout time, you can see that it's very proportionate to the growth of the church. And so with the increase of membership and the increase of temples, there's opportunities for increased study in this topic. But how do we assess architectural perceptions? So what is a temple to a Mormon? To a non-Mormon, how does the temple act as a symbol of faith? What messages are conveyed by its architecture? What architectural qualities are important for a temple? And can religious persuasion and or encounters with sacred spaces affect one's perception of the ideal temple? And then how do we map this empirically? So my research is based off of two comparative historians of religion. Mercedes Eliade and Lindsay Jones. They're both the editors of the Encyclopedia of Religion. And specifically, Lindsay Jones provides a conceptual model for how one goes about interpreting and designing sacred architecture, ritual, and experience. So I've taken his framework and essentially conducted a survey to see what people perceive a temple to be. So in and of that, the method is essentially going from a theoretical framework to a survey to test the framework, and then how does that apply to designers specifically? So Lindsay Jones also describes what we might call a ritual architectural event, which comprises one, buildings, architecture, the built form, two, the ritual or the ceremony, which gathers people together. Three, people to come with their expectations, their beliefs, their traditions, their culture, and put them together and you get an experience or some type of transformative event. So looking at how this might apply to the design process, designers kind of act as spatial choreographers. Religious clergy or leaders are often kind of the ritual choreographers, and then you have people who come to the buildings, and then you have essentially an experience. So how was the survey conducted? One, it was through the internet and in paper format. The survey responses were collected for 1 month. There were 8 questions about demographics, 34 about temples and their architecture, and essentially all of Jones's categories and definitions were simplified for the general public. And over 100 survey responses in the end were collected. So when we look at the demographics, there's a fairly wide distribution between education, age levels, occupations, and gender is kind of split down the center, which is ideal when we're looking at survey research. So specifically religion, however, we find that there's a fairly distributed population between such as Catholic, Protestants, other religions, atheists, etc. But this other Christian category falls into the Latter-day Saint or the Mormons. So when you look at the data, really 61% of the participants were LDS or reported they were LDS, and the other 39% were non-Mormon. So cutting the data between these two groups, we start to find specific traits. So here's the 34 questions that were asked regarding what is a temple. And you can start to see the trends between the different religions. But when we specifically look at Mormon perceptions of what a temple is, you find that any response or question that received over 66% approval had a high receptivity to it. So we find that for 82% of all of the questions asked. For the non-Mormon perceptions, we find similar but slightly less, with 65% of the questions that were highly accepted. But when we look at the two religious groups together, we find that there were major similarities, meaning there was only a 33% difference between how people responded for 28 of the 34 questions, and there was major differences for 6 of the categories. So, we can look at percentages all day long, but the main thing is, statistically, was religion a factor in how someone answered the question? So, using some statistical tests to see that relationship, we found that 13 categories specifically had a relationship with religion and how that question was answered. So that just tells you, okay, there was a one-to-one relationship, but it doesn't tell you how strong the relationship was. For example, what are the odds of a Mormon saying that a temple uses a revealed plan, for instance, versus a non-Mormon? So we use the odds ratio. So anything above 1 means that being Mormon is associated with a higher odds of the outcome. Anything less than 1 is associated with lower odds. So let's get into the results, the meat and the potatoes. So first and foremost, one question asked, is a temple a resting place for the dead? So specifically, we find in other traditions, such as Judaism, that the dead are viewed as impure and profane. And all burials, tombs, etc., were outside the city walls and outside the temple mount. Except for, of course, the kings, which is another topic. But we also find this practice still continuing all the way from the 8th century up until present. Jews, for the most part, and Muslims are buried on the Mount of Olives, on the east of the Temple Mount. So this hope of resurrection, but also the idea that this is where the blood of the sacrifices drained and was seen as the impure place. So, what about Mormonism? Do we have tomb and temple together? Well, in Nauvoo, there was actually a tomb constructed for Joseph Smith. Specifically, around 1844, right before his martyrdom, one visitor to Nauvoo said, when the Mormons began to rear their gorgeous temple, two tombs of hewn stone were built on the west side of the edifice. And now archaeologists have been able to track that this was on the southeast corner of the temple lot. But the idea of tomb also falls into play with some other LDS temples, specifically at Kirtland, Manti, and Winter Quarters. You find that temples are built adjacent to or in close proximity to cemeteries. So there's this connection between the importance of vicarious work or for the dead. So looking at the results of the survey, Latter-day Saints, only 7% said that a temple is a resting place for the dead. But 17% of non-LDS said it was. So when we look at the odds, we find that for the LDS, we go in the negative. But how strong is that relationship? So for a non-Mormon person, it's 7 times more significant. Another concept is Imago Mundi, which is an architectural expression of a downsized replica of the universe. In the Hindu tradition, we see that the temple itself is a geometric diagram, and that it's viewed as this microscopic or miniature model of the universe. But there's also the idea that from the center of the temple, energy and power emanate outward. We also find that the god or the deity was always placed at the center of the temple and surrounded by other planetary divinities. Man is also seen as a temple, and the navel being the center mark and the most sacred. But this is also expressed in the architectural form with the pyramidal shape and the tower. So how does this play in the LDS temple? In the Alberta, Canada temple, for example, we have the celestial room, which is located in the center of the temple, kind of like the Provo in Ogden that you were mentioning, Lex. It's articulated by a pyramidal form, so the most important space is pronounced. But there's also the idea in LDS scripture that light and power proceed forth from the presence of God out to fill the immensity of space. We also find this pattern on the facades of some LDS temples with iconography of stones, sunstones, moonstones, earthstones, etc. But specifically, you see here in Nauvoo and Salt Lake that the temples really are portraying a cosmic vision. What is the first thing when you look up in the sky? Well, you're standing on the earth, but you see the moon. And then the next, you see the sun. And then furthest away, you see the stars. So, Mormons were a little more favorable to this idea, and they agreed, 22% of them, that a temple is a miniature model of the universe, compared to the 7% of non-Mormons. And so, you have roughly four times more likely to agree with this statement than non-LDS. In terms of sacred episodes of history, which is when we commemorate an episode like the creation, the fall, enlightenment, etc., you find in the Judeo-Christian model that the Jewish temple, the early Christian, Catholic basilicas, etc., were tripartite. It means they have three spaces. The Holy of Holies, or the sanctuary, the holy place, or the nave, and then the courtyard, or the narthex. And each of these were associated with a period of sacred history, such as like the creation, or a fallen world, or a Garden of Eden, etc. And we also find this in the LDS tradition, specifically in the older temples, where you have 5 rooms and a sequence of space that are associated with specific periods in time of history. So nearly half of Latter-day Saints agreed that a temple honors sacred events in history. And so compared to the non-LDS response, Mormons were 5 times more likely to agree with this question. There's another concept such as Axis Mundi, which is really an architectural expression of a vertical axis between worlds, but it's also the horizontal symbolism of the center. So in the Catholic tradition in Florence, we have an example of this from the 12th century, where we have a sanctuary in apse with the high altar located directly above the crypt and its altar. So this idea of there's heaven, the heavenly realm, and then the underworld or the dead realm. So another more contemporary example in San Francisco, in the Cathedral of Christ the Light, you have a similar idea and concept where you have the high altar, the main congregation space, located directly above the crypt or the mausoleum where the dead bodies are placed. So does this exist in LDS temples? Yes. There's quite a few temples that have a celestial room placed directly above the baptistry. So here's an example in the Mesa, Arizona temple where this is the case. There's also the idea of the horizontal center. So in Judaism, ancient maps often depicted Jerusalem at the center of the world, and often the temple at the center of the city. In the LDS tradition, we find the similar phenomenon, where the temple marks the center of the city. It's the 00 placeholder in, I guess you could say, the city cosmos. And wherever you are in relation to the city, north, south, east, or west, you always know how far you are from the temple. So looking at the survey response, about half of Latter-day Saints agree that a temple's location is a sacred gathering place or axis. And then roughly the odds of being Mormon and responding to this question are about 5 times greater. So archetypes. This is another concept. That architecture imitates a celestial precedent, a model found in heaven. So in Judaism, we find this pattern. Moses received a pattern on Mount Sinai for the tabernacle, a sacred space. He saw the heavenly temple and replicated it on the earth. And that pattern in the tabernacle was then replicated again in the Jerusalem temple, which was just doubled in size. But does this exist in the Mormon tradition? Brigham Young said, Joseph Smith, the prophet, not only received revelation and commandment to build a temple, but he received a pattern also, as did Moses for the tabernacle and Solomon for his temple. So here you have the Kirtland Temple informing, which was received through a divine revelation and seen a model in heaven and patterned into the Nauvoo and then subsequently into the Salt Lake Temple. So Latter-day Saints also, about half of them, agreed that temple architecture copies a heavenly pattern or design. But the odds increase significantly. The odds of a Mormon saying that this was the case was about 16 times greater than non-Mormons. So next, and closely related, is the idea of a revealed plan. That architecture was delivered by divine revelation or decree. So in Judaism, we just explained that Moses received a pattern for the tabernacle. And that pattern was used to construct it and was shown to him in the mount. So in the LDS, we find the similar case with the Kirtland Temple. God said, let a house be built not after the manner of the world, but let it be built after the manner which I shall show unto three of you. Which, as historical facts concur, later on it was the first presidency of that time that received a vision of the Kirtland Temple. So Latter-day Saints, about 42%, agreed that the architect of a temple uses a revealed plan and measurements from God. And this was about 17 times more likely for them to agree than the non-Mormon, which was only 6%. So what about cosmogony? Which is essentially, how do we commemorate creation stories and myths? In the Hindu tradition, we have Angkor Wat, which is kind of a macro urban scale development. But the moat surrounding the temple complex embodies the Southeast Asian creation story. It's the churning of the cosmic sea of milk, kind of the battle between good and evil before the world was created. In the LDS tradition, specifically those rooms with 5-room sequences, you have a creation room. And the murals encompassing these rooms often depict the various phases of creation. In the Los Angeles Temple, you find a similar pattern, but also that the room itself is shaped in the form of a vesica Pisces, this almond shape, which historically has been used as a symbol of creation, the seed of the woman, etc. So Kazmagani, does a temple, can it honor the creation of heaven and earth? Mormons were very positive on this. About two-thirds agreed that this was the case, only a third of non-Mormons. And in terms of odds, Mormons were 18 times more likely to agree with this category. The next is a sanctified refuge. So how does architecture restrict access and guard the integrity of the architectural space or the ritual proceedings? We find, for example, in Judaism, this is the case. Ascending the mount was a difficult task. It often promoted inaccessibility. But the pilgrimage to the Temple Mount was a process. You also had multiple courts and walls to restrict access and promote solitude. So the various courts were divided. As you got closer to the actual temple, you could see exclusivity starting to happen, where anywhere from your religious persuasion segregated you to your gender to even the priestly caste. So in Latter-day Saints, temple sites are often built on elevated terrain, and they're usually surrounded by a perimeter fence and constructed on a platform. This idea of kind of restricting access, but it's the ascension journey that creates this idea of a sanctified refuge. You also have, once you start to enter the temple, a recommend desk, which acts as a physical and often visual gate or barrier where only the worthy or initiated are able to enter. In the temple, you also have a hierarchy of spaces. The baptistry, as we learned, was often at the lowest point in the temple, and the highest point is often the sealing rooms, the crowning ordinance. But the spatial sequence itself, specifically in the endowment ordinance or ritual, passes through a series of rooms or thresholds in order to enter the final space of the celestial room. So once again, Latter-day Saints, about two-thirds, accepted that a temple restricts its access in order to help keep it separate and sacred. So this is about 22 times more likely than the non-Mormons, which, in historically speaking, other religions' sacred space used to be restricted to only those who were initiated. But now, in our more free society and open-minded, they open the doors to anyone. So that's why LDS is often seen as odd. But there's another concept called hierophany, which is, in essence, when architecture celebrates a location or place when the sacred makes itself manifest. So in Jerusalem, we have Abraham and Isaac and their sacrifice on Mount Moriah, which was the later Temple Mount, and the appearance of an angel. So there's a manifestation of the divine. You have King Solomon when he dedicates the temple, that God's presence fills the edifice. And then in Islam, you have Muhammad on the same spot who ascends into heaven in a vision, a night journey on the Temple Mount, and is now marked by the Dome of the Rock. So does this exist in the LDS tradition? We find one of the most powerful places is the Sacred Grove in Palmyra, New York, where a temple was erected, specifically looking towards that special place. You also have the Manti Temple and the St. George Temple, which were believed by Brigham Young to have been dedicated by Moroni or former Nephites from the Book of Mormon. So, about 61% of Latter-day Saints said that a temple represents sacredness. And in comparison to the non-LDS, that's about 25 times more likely to agree with that. But what about architecture as a place of negotiation, and how is certain rituals used? In the Catholic tradition, you find that historically, at the portal, the gate, or the door of the church in the narthex, you have the penitents who are trying to re-enter God's presence. And specifically, they ask for forgiveness from the bishop who's representing Christ. And you also have other examples where Christ is the literal doorkeeper, the gatekeeper who lets you into God's presence. So you find this idea also in other churches with the altars and the idea of atonement or reconciliation. But also before confession booths were created, you have a confession that took place at a symbolic veil or a rood screen, which was conducted between the priest and the penitent. So in the Latter-day Saint tradition, you have the idea of prayer, covenants, contracts that are made often at altars. You have a symbolic interaction at a veil. Similar to the Catholic, you have a celestial room, which acts as a place of prayer where the divine makes itself manifest. Revelation occurs, and it's a place of contemplation. So Latter-day Saints, about two-thirds, agreed that a temple is a place of prayer or negotiation with God. This was about 27 times more likely than non-LDS. So what about construction itself and the process as an offering to God? In the Shinto religion in Japan, we have the Ishi Grand Shrine. This shrine, specifically, there's two sites located next to each other, and the old shrine is dismantled, and a new one is constructed on the adjacent site every 20 years. So every 20 years, you destroy one temple, and you rebuild the exact same temple right next door. So this is part of this idea of renewal and regeneration. In the LDS tradition, we find that there's a groundbreaking ceremony, the site dedication. There's the laying of the cornerstones in the early LDS temples, which was the four cornerstones in a clockwise direction. There's the placing of the Angel Moroni statue, not an official construction process or ritual, but many people often gather to watch it occur. Then there's the capstone or the final cornerstone ceremony, often conducted by the first presidency of the church, the temple dedication, and the periodic rebuilding or remodeling of temples to help to keep them pleasing unto God. So the idea of the Ogden Temple we were talking about earlier. So the temple building and its construction are meant to please God was accepted by about 61% of Latter-day Saints and about 23% of non-LDS. This is about 52 times more likely for the Latter-day Saints to agree with this because it's very prominent in the religious culture. But there's also an idea in sacred architecture that the dead can somehow progress in the afterlife through the architecture, this idea of transmutation or reactualization. So in the Egyptian temples, this was very much the case. You have the pharaohs and building these elaborate temple complexes and pyramids where the dead were stored. Why? In part, it was because there's a belief that the dead could rise again. So light, specifically, was a source of power and life. And the rays of the sunlight first touch the point of the mountaintop, but bring life and power down into the dark gray or the underworld where the sleeping dead are. And is this idea that a sign of the triumph over death. So Latter-day Saints have a similar practice. By way of commandment, they were told to place their fonts for baptisms for the dead underneath the ground where the living are wont to assemble, to help reinforce the realm of the dead, which is, and baptism itself, is a similitude of the grave. So here you have in the Nauvoo Temple, for example, a fulfillment of that commandment. So Latter-day Saints and non-LDS, there's a big disparity in how they responded to this question, that a temple can help the dead or deceased ancestors progress in the afterlife. As some of you may know, that's a primary tenet of the Latter-day Saint tradition. So LDS were 56 times more likely to agree with this statement about temples. And one of the more prominent ones is a house of deity. How is architecture conceived as an abode, residence, or house of God? Going back to the Hindu tradition, the temple itself was built to replicate the mythological mountain home of the gods. So the temple itself was a temporary abode for the gods in the world of man. So there's always this potential for the divine, or the divine to make itself manifested, but it only occurs occasionally. In the LDS tradition, we find a similar commandment. They're given the instructive to establish a house, even a house of God, so that God's presence could come and dwell there, and the pure in heart could actually see God. So somewhat similar to the Hindu tradition. And the idea that the temple is the Lord's house, and it is a mountain, and it is established in the tops of the mountains. So 61% of Latter-day Saints said that temples are the home or house of God, and only 18% of non-Mormons did. But this was the highest ranking in terms of odds, the odds ratio. Latter-day Saints were 150 times more likely to accept that a temple is a house of God versus non-Latter-day Saints. So in terms of the conclusions, what is a Mormon temple? It is a house of God. It is a place that helps the dead to progress in the afterlife. It is built as an offering meant to please God. It is a place of prayer and negotiation with God. It's a place representing sacredness. It restricts its access to keep it separate and sacred. It's designed to honor the creation. It is based on a revealed plan. It's a copy of a heavenly pattern or design. And it's a sacred gathering place or vertical access between worlds. It's designed to honor sacred events. And by very few, it's seen as a miniature model of the universe. And as we saw earlier, most Latter-day Saints do not view it as a burial or resting place for the dead, but there is that close association with the realm of the dead. So what are the limitations of this study? Every study has its limitations. First, there's a bias towards those who participated. There is a belief that a building can have meaning and be sacred. 96% of those who participated had some kind of belief that a building could be sacred. There was that potential. It's also a non-probability sample, so it's non-scientific, meaning that you can't infer it to the general Mormon population or the non-Mormon population. It's also a pilot study with a small proportion of respondents. But how does this apply to designers? First, it gives a holistic approach. How do you improve the interconnectivity between architecture, ritual, culture, religion, and experience? It also gives a method for assessing people's perceptions and expectations of what a temple should be. And so this informs the design process in and of itself. So as we looked at earlier, how the design process essentially occurs, you have the architecture coming through the designers, the religious leaders prescribing the ritual or the ceremonies, and then people coming with their various expectations or beliefs, and put those together and you get some type of event or experience. And how a survey can begin to inform that. Let's say before a temple is built, you conduct a survey in the local area to see the insider perception of what a temple is and the outsider. In a way to improve what a temple should be. So future research. There's additional large-scale survey needed in order to make those broader inferences against the general Latter-day Saint population. But it's also taking this theoretical approach from theory to practice and how it informs designs. But also other researchers might be able to take this information and explore Latter-day Saint temples based on the initial findings. So when we think in and of a temple itself, we see that, as former church president Gordon B. Hinckley said, the temple and its ordinances are the most profound expression of our theology. I'll leave with that. Thank you. So I know we have time for questions.
I just thought I'd mention, I can't remember the name of the book, and it's out in DVD. Also, the missionaries like to show it. And I read the book last year. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's about a person of a very nefarious character who became enlightened and joined the Mormon Church. I think it's from Chicago, from a gangster orientation.
Mm-hmm. That sounds familiar.
And what inspired him was he came to Salt Lake City for some activity, and he saw the temple. And it was like a switch, and his sole objective, he was basically converted just by looking at the temple, and his sole objective at that time was to become a worthy member so he could enter the temple. And it's a very inspirational story. It's a good DVD. I think it really personifies exactly, in the LDS culture, what it can do for a unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, thank you.
You know, on some of those questions, I would have thought the Mormon response would have been 100%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Seems like...
No brainer.
Right. Brainer. And it was still like 67%.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
How do you account for that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Let me go back to another slide real quick. So specifically...
Do you not know what the temple is for?
So when we look at some of the questions that are asked, there was a few. Let's see this one specifically that had very high percentages in the 90, almost 100% range. But when you do a statistical test to see what is the likelihood of religion again, and this is kind of the nature of statistics in general, when you run a test like this, you're taking just religion in general, so all those different religions that responded, and then testing that against their responses to this specific question, and is there a correlation? So it's not taking LDS specifically,
okay,
and just narrowing it out of the survey bundle, but that's part of why it occurred that way.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I just have to ask, did you include or have you considered or as a part of, what about the Masonic temples? Any comments about that?
Sure. There are quite a few parallels, as you probably know. And early Latter-day Saint temples were heavily influenced by Masonic rituals. But one thing that I've noted in another publication is that there is a lot of parallels to early Christian, ancient Jewish traditions, specifically looking at the sequence of rooms, which is nowhere found in the Masonic temple.
That's true.
And its ordinances.
That's true.
Let me just go back here. Yeah. So, in terms of sacred history, this idea that each part of the church represented something. So, how ancient Jews understood the temple and how early Christians understood the basilica as a replica of the temple, and then what is the experience of progression actually starting, and the way the high priest started the ritual, he started here. He didn't start here and then go there, but essentially he brought blood here, made an atonement, the idea of creation, goes to the Garden of Eden, the table of shewbread goes out to the courtyard, then the millennial era when a Messiah comes, goes back into the holy place, which is the new Garden of Eden, or the restored earth, the tree of life, and then back into God's presence. So it's the LDS experience, which is found nowhere in the Masonic tradition, but you can find many parallels in that. So.
You know, I lived in San Diego for a while, and when I was attending the San Diego Temple, they would talk, and I'm sorry, I'm going to be so vague, because this is like half remembered, and I barely understood it then.
Sure.
But in the San Diego Temple, there was like this one motif used over and over again in all kinds of design elements as well as in the architecture. And the story I heard, and it was probably fifth hand by the time it got to me, was that this motif was revealed to the architect as having some kind of connection to, you know, an ancient temple somewhere. Does that story ring any bells to you whatsoever?
Yes. Actually, I know the architect, friends with him, Bill Lewis is his name, and I used to live in San Diego, so I'm very familiar with that temple. And what she's describing is there's two squares overlapping, and one's rotated 45 degrees, so you have kind of an eight-pointed star. They found, and I think actually I've got an image of it here. But in a lot of ancient Christian churches, yeah, here it is. So in Ravenna, there's a couple mosaics. And you have here an altar. Here's Melchizedek. And then here is that symbol, the double square. So Hugh Nibley, so the way the story goes when I interviewed Bill Lewis is he was working on the design and was looking for some kind of motif, a repeating motif that could be continued all through the temple. And this is a practice that like Frank Lloyd Wright used to use and things like that. And they finally decided on this double square, and it just started to work everywhere. And so as going through the temple, later on in the dedication, one of the project managers said, "Does this mean anything?" And lots of news people asked, and the church said no. But the project manager took this symbol, and he took it to Hugh Nibley, which was kind of a notorious LDS scholar, and he said, "That is the seal of Melchizedek." And so it's become used. Anyways, the project manager took that then to Bill Lewis, told him about it. Bill Lewis got really excited. He went and told President Hinckley, "This is, you know, according to Hugh Nibley, an ancient symbol that, through inspiration by haphazard coincidence, came back and is now used all over the temple." President Hinckley went and talked to Hugh Nibley, confirmed it, and that's kind of how the story goes.
Like a restoration.
Yeah. And now you'll find actually that symbol on the front glass doors of the entrance of the Salt Lake Temple, all over a lot of new temples. But right now the church is kind of going away from direct symbols and iconography, sun, moons, and stars. For specific reasons, because sometimes people read too much into the symbol and look beyond the symbol, kind of how some scripture talks about the Jews looking beyond the mark.
That's very appropriate for some cultures.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much for more advances in the work.
Yes.
For cultures such as ours.
Yeah, exactly. So I hope that answered your question and clarifies it a little bit.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Any other questions? Thoughts? Comments?
Excellent.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.